Well, what would you do in a war? The title for this address does not, as you might expect, necessarily come from the current international conflicts. It comes partly from something that lies under my bed. It's a left-handed golf putter, which has a wooden handle, which has been chewed by visiting dogs over many years. Why, the question arose, do you have a left-handed putter under your bed? Well, you might guess why. It's as protection in the event of a nighttime burglar. But then the question kept coming. How much force would you use on someone who might not want to do you personal harm, but just might want your watch? What if you seriously injure the intruder? And when does seeming defense become offense? All of which begs many questions, particularly in the current international climate. Indeed, perhaps now more than in the last decade, we may be facing the ultimate choice. How do we deal with issues surrounding violence and war? Even in the smallest way, we may feel the effects of international conflict, which would oblige us to make ethical decisions on whether to engage in fighting, materially support one of the rival factions, or offer sanctuary to some of the millions of people who would be displaced in a conflict. Now, indeed, it may be time to decide, not in the heat of battle, however far away that could be, or when the armies come marching in, where do we stand on violence, either as a resister of aggression or in taking anticipatory action in the possibly mistaken view that we are about to be attacked? And then the other vital question from where would we get the information which would lead us to a particular stance, for example, in the event of a belligerent force invading? Is it the case of my country right or wrong, where our attitude could be dictated by the prevailing political view? Or would our verdict emerge from a considered examination of conscience on the rights or wrongs of a proposed action? A one-time activist has said, the last decision would come under the pacifist umbrella. I'm not too sure. But although there is a persuasive argument which refers to the pacifism of the honest study of cases, which I think is somewhat similar to just war theory. As articulated by John Howard Yoder in his book, Nevertheless, Varieties of Religious Pacifism, pacifism of the honest study of cases means that we would be obligated to study in detail the characteristics of why a particular war might be justified. Under these criteria, we must, says Yoder, evaluate the cause for which a war is fought, the authority in whose name it's undertaken, and the methods to be used. And of course, as we know, there are other forms of religious pacifism. Yoder outlines them: the pacifism of absolute principle, where the command, thou shalt not kill, is absolute and without any exceptions; the pacifism of programmatic political alternatives, which claims that war is not a solution to any problem; the pacifism of non-violent social change, where non-violence as a tool of social change has a decided advantage over violence. And then the pacifism of prophetic protest, whereby, for example, we might withhold a certain percentage of our income tax that goes to the military. I knew a Mennonite who said he did that in Ireland. And the pacifism of the categorical imperative, which asks, what would happen if everybody allowed themselves to engage in war? And then if we look at just war theory, A.C. Grayling, the British philosopher, says the theory goes back to Thomas Aquinas, who examined the proposition, is it always sinful to engage in war? Aquinas believed this was not true, that war was justified on three conditions. A just cause, it is started on proper authority, and that it is waged with the right intention, the advancement of good or the avoidance of evil. Two other conditions have been added in modern times. The war must have a reasonable chance of success, and the means used to conduct it must be proportional to the ends sought. Many will query the words proper authority, but this originally Catholic theory has stood the test of time and has avoided, I believe, the extreme of war being designated as always wrong. It is nuanced even regarding nuclear disarmament. Disappointing absolute pacifists who believe all use of armed force to be morally wrong. But the Roman Catholic hierarchy position is that while the prevention of nuclear war is its aim, it does not want to risk the possibility that unilateral disarmament might provoke such a war should an aggressor take advantage of a vulnerable opponent. This is from the New Dictionary of Theology. But anyway, the morality and the circumstances of many violent actions in time of conflict, as we're learning now in the Middle East and in the Russian-Ukrainian fighting, is to say the least confusing. And largely this is because of the discordant voices and huge doubts from whence our information comes. Even if we trust the honesty of our foreign correspondents, and we're lucky in Ireland to be able to do so, we do not know the extent to which the information given, or which they glean, has been distorted by wily PR and press advisors, or indeed by diplomatic sources anxious to put a gloss on raw information to suit the sensibilities of their own particular governments. And we're all familiar with the misuse of language, as outlined in his book, Unspeak, by Stephen Poole. And he calls unspeak a mode of speech that persuades by stealth, for example, words like climate change instead of climate warming, coalition of the willing, war on terror, collateral damage. John Simpson, the veteran BBC correspondent, in his book Unreliable Sources, goes back 100 years to Ireland to make a point. After Bloody Sunday in Croke Park, when about 14 people were killed by the auxiliaries, before that there had been about 14 intelligence officers had been killed in Dublin. And he makes the point that the British newspapers were not willing to make a connection between the two events. And it was actually the London Times which finally had the courage to say that the Crown forces had themselves committed acts of terrorism and violence of which no disciplined force should be guilty. And throughout the decades, there have been multitudinous incidents where the official efforts, successfully or otherwise, sought to manipulate information. Information which, and I think this is the significant thing, could have allowed people to make considered ethical choices on whether to engage in war or agree with its continuation. To be frank, however, there are only limited chances of us getting full and accurate information during and indeed before a conflict. Many studies have highlighted this, and just a few random examples. Tom Bouverie tells us in his book, Appeasing Hitler, that before World War II, huge pressure was put on the London Evening Standard to stop its cartoonist upsetting the Germans. Many will know of Philip Knightley's wonderful book, The First Casualty. We all heard about the fabricated story about Saddam Hussein's forces taking babies out of incubators and throwing them on the ground, which turned out to be totally untrue. And then there are some other well-known works. Anyone Here Been Raped and Speaks English? Ireland, the Propaganda War by Liz Curtis, and a seminal book called Gotcha, which is about the Falklands War, which had so much false information emanating from the British sources. And we mustn't forget, too, how victors can change the narrative, which can lead to later violence. How many people know, and I have to say I didn't, that in 1923 the French and the Belgians invaded the Ruhr, Germany's heartland, in a row over reparation delays after World War I, and about the evil behavior of the occupying French and Belgian forces? This has been charted recently by Mark Jones, an assistant professor up in UCD. And another issue, if we are invaded, how should we ethically respond? This is a dilemma which millions of people in World War II had to confront. Is it right to continue futile existence if many more civilians could die? A question posed and answered in many ways by French people who either resisted, accommodated themselves to the Germans, or cooperated with the puppet regime in Vichy France. And this dilemma was faced in microcosm in the Channel Islands when the Germans arrived. And it was agreed between the people who lived on the island and the Germans that there would be what they called a model occupation. Madeleine Bunting, in her book on this issue, she says that every islander was faced with uncomfortable choices. Where did patriotism end and self-preservation begin? And what moral obligation did the islanders have to the thousands of emaciated and ill-treated slave laborers the Nazis brought with them to build defenses? The full story on the island of Alderney, for instance, is only now being investigated, only now, 4 decades after an observer journalist claimed that Karl Hoffmann, who the Nazi commandant of the camp, that he had been allowed to stay in Britain and return home after the war, where he died in his bed in Berlin in 1974. The British had always claimed that he had been handed over to the Soviets. Truth, as Philip Knightley says, is the first casualty of war. So perhaps we may agree three things. We may agree three things. Maybe most debatable is that a person can be regarded as a pacifist, and there are various versions of pacifism as outlined, if he or she makes a conscientious decision about how to respond to a particular war situation. Second, it can be difficult to get accurate information on how to make such decisions. And third, there is an ethical issue on how populations should respond if their territory is invaded. Yoder says, "The loser in any war would always have been better off to have made peace sooner rather than later, even against an absolutely unjust aggressor." And he says that this was demonstrated by the experience of Denmark and the Low Countries in World War II, the Hungarians in 1956, the Czechs in 1968, and the Poles in 1980. He says, their capacity to resist and later to rise up again was greater precisely because they accepted defeat soon enough to leave their society intact. And if we look to our own treaty negotiations in 1921, when David Lloyd George promised immediate and terrible war if the treaty wasn't signed, we could think perhaps that this was very much in the minds of the Irish negotiators. Today's Ukrainians may take a different stance, particularly as Yoder reminds us that at the Yalta Peace Conference in 1945, in return for the support of Stalin, the United States and Britain conceded to this appalling tyrant control over half of Europe. So, besides the pacifism of the honest study of cases and just war theory, where else might we go for advice on how to respond to violent conflict? Well, we may not need to go much further than Muhammad Ali. In 1967, while explaining why he refused to fight in Vietnam, he said, "Why should they ask me to put on a uniform and go 10,000 miles from home and drop bombs and bullets on brown people in Vietnam after so-called Negro people in Louisville are treated like dogs and denied simple human rights?" Here, Ali identified with his possible victims and had an acute sense of their personhood. He was, however, unintentionally speaking to that of God in every man, as the Quakers say, Quakers who have been a shining light in working for peace. Or indeed, we could look to the example of Costa Rica. Costa Rica has no army and didn't even resurrect one during a nasty dispute with Nicaragua. And this is regarded as quite significant, although to take the gloss off a bit, apparently it was realized that having an army can mean the army will take over the democratically elected politicians. Sometimes, having been so far protected from foreign invasion, we unintentionally overlook the horrors of war, although less likely recently. Even this island's experience of IRA and loyalist atrocity is far removed from the minds of our young people, and who, while they might just about agree that Dad's army is the BBC's Dad's Army is funny do not often seem to engage with the background story about the suffering of millions of people during World War II. It is perhaps time that we, and they did, and perhaps align with pacifists, if that's what they can be termed, of the honest study of cases, obliging an intelligent look at each demand to engage or support a war, a stance which falls between the permissive and the absolutist principle of refusing ever to be involved. This is not, of course, to gainsay the highly principled and brave stance of Quakers and Mennonites and many others who have resisted involvement in war, nor indeed those who believe that in the cause of what they would term right, war is usually acceptable. It is just to posit the view, and I know many will disagree, that circumstances do alter cases when it comes to war, and that as Unitarians, we are at the very least obliged to formulate a considered view. Amen, and thank you.